Hi, you're listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.
University of Sussex. So over to you, come in.
Thank you. Is this working okay? Yeah? Okay, great. So what I want to talk to you about is it's drawn from the book Decolonizing the University, which I edited with two other colleagues, and it came out last year. And in a way, the book came about as a consequence of there being an intensification of student protests within universities over at least the last sort of 5 years. And many of these protests were dealing with issues of racial exclusion and racialized hierarchy within universities. Including within both teaching and research practices. So within the UK, there was the Rhodes Must Fall movement, Oxford, which started actually in the universities in South Africa with Rhodes Must Fall happening there. There was also movements around Why Is My Curriculum White? And broader struggles to decolonize education across the UK. There were protests more globally around caste injustice at Hyderabad University and JNU in India. And in the US, I'm sure you've heard of the Black Lives Matter protests, which were happening both across campuses but also across civil society more generally. And what these movements were pointing towards were really urgent concerns about how we teach and research, and also how the resources of universities might be used to support the amelioration of injustice rather than its reproduction. So what I want to do in the time I have today is identify some of the main issues in relation to these protests, particularly in terms of the curriculum, in terms of who and what gets included and excluded, and then also indicate some actions that can be taken to mitigate against those aspects that we find troubling. I'm not going to talk for the full hour. I'll talk for about half an hour, 35 minutes or so, and then what I'd really welcome is the conversation with you in terms of questions, comments that you might have about what I've been saying. So in the context of debates regarding the necessity of literature to reflect multicultural constituencies, I remember somebody saying one time that books are both windows into other cultures, and they're also reflections of one's own, and that it's important for any corpus of books to provide both aspects for all children. So this was an article that was being written specifically in terms of children's literature. But if we scale that up, we see that there are ways in which the literature that we engage with ought to reflect both the experiences of people in their own lives as well as provide windows into other lives. And the question is partly whether university education, particularly in the humanities and social sciences, is doing that. In terms of a bit of background for myself, I mean, I grew up here, I went to a regular state school. And I remember going home after learning about the British in India and explaining to my dad how interesting it was that the British had built railways in India. My dad then sat me down and, you know, explained a few things. And in a way, what he did was really taught me to question what it was that I was getting from school and how one might sort of think from other places about the knowledge that was being presented. Now, the interesting thing is that whilst I did get some teaching about empire while I was at school, a lot of recent governmental initiatives have sought to remove the teaching of empire and colonialism from the curriculum. So, for example, when Michael Gove was Secretary of State for Education, one of the things that he tried to put through was that the teaching of history at the secondary school education ought to be redefined so that the only history children would learn would be that of our island story. And if you think that the history of Britain can be told simply in terms of what happens on this island, when the British Empire covered over a quarter of the world's territory, governed over one-fifth of its population, and actually at its sort of smallest limit is at least an island and a half, we might be able to understand why the current government has problems with remembering that Ireland, Northern Ireland, is part of who we are. So what I want to do really is talk about why it's important to work towards decolonizing the curriculum and suggest that in the context of doing that, we move away from thinking about this simply in terms of issues of inclusion and exclusion and rather think about it in terms of transformation. I'll also address the black and minority ethnic attainment gap, which I'll explain later, and I'll end with a discussion of the importance of thinking about how we construct our reading lists and resources within universities. So my place is the university. And the university can be seen, as John Dewey has argued, as one of the vital repositories of the common learning of communities. If we accept this understanding of the university, then we should also understand that as communities change, so our understandings of the present and the past are also transformed. I'll just use gender here initially as a way to illustrate the issues. When universities opened up to increasing numbers of women in the post-war period, and especially after the Robbins reforms, which created the system of mass higher education in the 1960s, one of the first things that women found was that women could not be found within these institutions. For some female scholars, this absence required address, and in terms of the curriculum of knowledge production, this was done by seeking to identify women both as the objects and subjects of research, and also by coming to argue for feminist perspectives across disciplines and areas. So they addressed both the issue of what was to be taught, as well as who it was taught by, and in the process, they changed these institutions. So, and this has become so commonplace now that no one really talks about the curriculum or universities being distorted or disfigured by the inclusion of women or by the inclusion of feminist perspectives. Or if they do that, as is happening in Hungary and Brazil and a few other places, then these critics are quite clearly identified as coming from right-wing positions bordering on fascism. So what are we to make of those who criticize the call to decolonize our institutions? I would suggest that just as some men found gender equality a challenge to their sense of self, it's not surprising, perhaps, that those whose sense of self is intimately tied to the idea of the British Empire as having been a force for good in the world are unsettled by arguments to the contrary. In this context, what I find surprising is how they locate such criticisms as forms of identity politics, when it's quite clear that the only politics of identity being peddled here is their own. So I'd like to give you an extended example to explain what I mean. Any number of commentators on being confronted by the British trade in human beings often respond by saying, yes, that was terrible, but we did abolish the trade. And it's correct, Britain did abolish the trade after about 200 years of profiting from it. But this was not the only thing that was done. As Catherine Hall and Nick Draper have made publicly known, Britain also paid compensation of £20 million. In today's money, that would be £17 billion. Or to put it another way, that's the equivalent of 40% of GDP. This money was paid to people who had lost property in the process. So just to be clear, enslaved people were not compensated for their loss of liberty. Rather, the people who had owned other people as property were compensated for their loss of property at the point of abolition. This money was used to fuel the Industrial Revolution. It built country houses, and it endowed public schools and Oxford and Cambridge colleges, art galleries and libraries. Going back to the issue of compensation, the Treasury rather ineptly tweeted a few months ago that we, that is British taxpayers, did not finish paying off the bond that had been raised to pay out this compensation until 2015. So if any of you paid tax in Britain prior to 2015, yes? If so, you've paid to compensate those people who had owned other people. That's part where part of your taxes went to. And it wasn't just taxpayers in the British national state who, through their taxes, paid to repay this bond, but actually people who paid income tax across the British Empire contributed to the compensation that was paid to compensate British slave owners and their descendants for ending the abomination that was slavery. Now, this fact very rarely makes it into discussions about abolition, Or if it does, there's usually some muttering about the rule of law and the necessity to compensate for the loss of property, however distasteful we might find the fact that people in a different time with different moralities had regarded it as possible to own other people. This claim, however, is not then followed by agreement with the idea of more general reparations to compensate those from across the colonial empire who had lost property. That is, those who had been dispossessed from their lands, whose right to property in themselves had been taken away from them, or in compensation for the resources that were extracted. The economist Utzer Patnaik has recently published work which demonstrates that over 200 years, the British state extracted over $45 trillion from India alone through resources, profits, taxes, and so on. And that's let alone what it then took from the rest of the colonial world. So if the rule of law and the right to be compensated for property is central to who we think we are, is central to our understanding of European values or British values or the Enlightenment, then why not generalize the process and compensate all those others? What's the obstacle to doing so? Saying that we know that slavery was wrong because we abolished it erases the historical narratives of those who had always opposed slavery, including successfully, for example, like with the Haitian Revolution. And it pretends that we knew it was wrong prior to others telling us so, even as we argue that it's not possible to judge the past according to the standards of the present. So which is it? Because logically, you can't have it both ways. The reason for presenting this extended example is to say that decolonizing the curriculum is about transforming the common sense narratives that we have about how the world we share in common was configured. If we don't adequately understand the shared histories that have produced us, then we have no hope of constructing a politics that will effectively address the many challenges that we face. This amnesia within Britain, at the heart of empire, of what empire actually was, is implicated in arguments about national sovereignty and national heritage, which are then used to securitize borders in the present and to argue for a differentiated form of citizenship. It's implicated in the current debates about who gets considered to belong and who just has residency rights, for now. And I would suggest that our institutions of learning are complicit in such reproduction to the extent that they do not adequately challenge the politics of selective memory that is reproduced every time we evade our past instead of confronting it directly and honestly. Such distortions are problematic in their own terms, but they're also increasingly implicated in the sense of dislocation and alienation that's experienced by many Black, Asian, and minority ethnic students at universities. And they're also said to play a part in what's being identified as the attainment or marking gap that's present within our institutions. And it's to this that I now turn. So just to give you a little bit of background to this, the Race Relations Amendment Act, which was passed in 2000, and it comes out of the McPherson Report on Institutional Racism, requires higher education institutions to eliminate unlawful discrimination and to promote equality of opportunity. And it requires institutions to be proactive in doing this. Now, what has been identified is that there is a gap in attainment, or people have begun talking about needing to talk about it as a gap in marking, because it's not clear that the issue is about attainment. But there is a gap between BAME students and white students in terms of the degree results that they get when they leave university. And that's even when BAME students enter university on the same grades as white students, and even when they have higher grades than white students, they leave with a 20 to 50% less of a chance of graduating with a good degree, that is with a 2-1 or a first. There is no gender gap. So men and women who enter on the same grades or equivalent grades leave with the same sorts of degree results. And there is no socioeconomic gap. So whether you come from a richer background or a poorer background, if you enter on the same grades, you tend to leave with similar degree results. The only gap that exists that we know of is a race gap. And that's something that's actually produced by the university. It's not just reproduced from broader social norms. But there's been no systematic consideration of racial inequality within universities. The only report that addresses racial inequality within education is the Swan Report, which was directed to schools and to the performance of children in schools. And it came out in 1985. And even though it's quite an old report, it's still one of the best documents that we have in terms of thinking of how we might want to think about addressing issues of racial inequality within education. One of the key things that it identifies is that what we need to keep at the forefront of our minds is how do we educate all children? So this isn't an issue of how to educate particular children. This is an issue of how we educate all children. And the ways in which we think about this has to be an inclusive solution to this. The other thing that they said, and I think is very, very important, is that they identified that underachievement in ethnic minority students is not the result of a deficit in the student. So it's not because the student is somehow lesser that they end up with lesser degrees. Because, as I said, you come in on the same grades. So if you've managed to get the same grades at A level, then what happens at university that means that you leave with a lower degree result? And they identified quite clearly in terms of schools that if a problem has been identified in schools, then what needs to be done is that the school needs to take responsibility for the production of that gap and then to deal with it. So just to give you a sense of where we are today, I don't know about the current GCSE results because they literally came out last week, but over the last 20 years generally, in absolute terms, the ethnic achievement gaps have basically disappeared at GCSE level. So at age 16, there are no statistically significant gaps in degree results obtained by students regardless of whatever ethnicity they come from. Pakistani and Black Caribbean children still underperform a little bit, but the gap is reduced considerably, but the lowest performance is from Gypsy, Roma and Irish Traveller children. There is still quite a significant gap in relation to them. But when socioeconomic advantage is taken into account, then all ethnic groups perform equal to white students at age 16. At age 18, with A-levels, Chinese and Indian students begin to outperform white students, with other Asian and mixed students getting equivalent results. However, at this stage, Black African and Black Caribbean students' results are much lower. So that's at A-levels. And then we go into higher education. And in higher education, in 2015-2016, 78.8% of white qualifiers in England received a first or a 2-1, compared with 63.2% of BME qualifiers. So that's a 15.6% gap. The outcomes do vary by ethnic group, so Chinese and Indian students do better, Pakistani students less well, and the students who have the least chance of getting a good 2-1 or first degree are Black other students, where only 50.5% of those students get a 2-1 or a first. So that's a gap of 28%, nearly 30%. Once we take out factors such as prior attainment, gender and age, there remains an unexplained difference between white and Black students of 17% and of 10% between white and Asian students. So this data comes from the Office for Students. The BME degree attainment gap is narrower for those studying science, engineering and technology and rather than those studying the humanities and social sciences. So what are the implications of this gap existing? So remember, this is a gap that's produced by universities. Now, we have to remember that entry to graduate level jobs requires a minimum of a 2-1 degree result. Applications for funding and bursaries also usually requires a minimum of a 2-1 degree result. So inequalities in marking have longer term consequences for BAME graduates who are less likely then to be able to benefit from those opportunities. This has an impact on their entry into the job market, the level of jobs that they can get, and it has an impact on their wages over the life course. And it has an impact on the academic pipeline, which means that it's more difficult for them to get funding to do PhDs and go on to become academics and therefore try and deal with these problems. So, what might we be able to do about these issues? We've identified that the issues do exist. I want to present you with one initiative that I've been involved in to try and address some of these sorts of issues. Some of the responses that have occurred, so students themselves have been protesting about this. So the campaigns around why is my curriculum white, how to want to liberate my degree and those sorts of things, they've been very much student-led to try and address the concerns that, you know, that students have around the issues that I've been identifying. The faculty have been responsive and have been trying to also address these issues, but we have to keep in mind that this is something that we're doing now, in part because students are also seen as consumers. So if students are paying their fees and there's such an unexplained gap in the outcomes that they're getting, they're asking, well, I've paid my 9,000 the same as this person's paid their 9,000. Why do I have a lower chance of getting a good result? What's going on there? So as much as I am opposed to the neoliberalization of higher education and the marketization of higher education that's gone on over the last 10 years, one thing that sort of perversely has come out of this has been the identification of particular sorts of inequalities and increased pressure upon institutions to do something about them. So what are the things that could be done? One of the things that I've been trying to think about is how one presents the research that one does into the teaching that's then also organized. So when I first started teaching at the first institution that I arrived at, I got given a course to teach, a first year course on modernity, the making of the modern world. And that's great. I'd just written a book called Rethinking Modernity. And so I got given this module handbook. It had all the modules in, the readings and everything. And it basically presented an argument for how the modern world came into being, which was everything that I had critiqued in the book that I had just written. So I'm a first, you know, this is my first permanent job. It's the first year I'm teaching. As teaching starts in about a month's time, what do I do? And so for the first year, I tried to teach what the standard curriculum was in the first half of the module, and then teach the critique in the second half of the module so that students would get a sense of what the alternatives were. And I thought that went fine, except when I got the student essays in at the end of the module, almost all the student essays said, "Isn't European modernity a wonderful thing?" And it's like, well, that wasn't quite what I was hoping you'd get out of the second half of the module, but okay. So then the next year I tried to change it again. I thought, well, okay, I could pair the topics. I could teach the Industrial Revolution and then I could teach colonialism. I could teach the French Revolution and then I could teach the Haitian Revolution so that the critique was paired with the topic that was presented as standard. And again, at the end of the module, every essay I got was, "Isn't European modernity wonderful?" And I thought, well, this really isn't working. I don't know quite, you know, how do I get to students to think sort of beyond what the standard position is? And then as I was talking to friends and colleagues about this, one of the things that I realized is that however much I might present a critical perspective in the classroom, everything that exists in the world around them tells them that the Industrial Revolution began in Britain. And from Britain, it spread round to the rest of the world. I mean, if I was just to do a straw poll and ask you, where did the Industrial Revolution begin? What would be your immediate sort of thing? What do you associate it with?
Birmingham.
Where else? Why Birmingham?
Penang Villages.
And what did it produce?
Textiles.
Textiles, cotton. So often when I do this talk, people talk about cotton. And where was the cotton produced? Manchester and Lancaster. So if you ask somebody, where is the heart of the Industrial Revolution? They might say Western Europe. And you're like, but where really? Oh, Britain. Okay, but where in Britain? Manchester and Lancaster. Why? Because of cotton. And then it's like, okay, but cotton isn't a plant that's native to Britain, let alone to Europe. Cotton comes from India, as does the technology of how to dye and weave it. It was grown in the southern states of the US and the Caribbean by Africans who had been stolen and transported there as part of the European trade in human beings. The raw product was then brought back to Manchester and Lancaster, where it was turned into cloth, but that cloth was of such inferior quality that it had to be sold at the point of a gun around the world because people didn't actually want to buy it. So something that we think of as the Industrial Revolution that then becomes global actually had global conditions that enabled the Industrial Revolution to occur. So you couldn't have had the Industrial Revolution if you didn't already have globalization, or as I call it, colonialism. And so in that sense, one of the things that I then did was, and then partly the students were protesting themselves, asking, you know, why is my curriculum white and so on. And I thought, do you know what? Instead of tinkering about with this module, I'm going to rewrite this module to start with, what if we started with critique as the norm? Instead of presenting critique as the minor position, what if we presented critique as the norm and then see what happens? So I rewrote the module as Race and the Making of the Modern World. We started with talking about dispossession, extraction, appropriation. We discussed famine. We looked at the relationship between Ireland and the Bengal. We looked at other sorts of issues in relation to this. And then suddenly, it was as if space had been provided for the students to explore things in a different sort of mode. They were no longer constrained by what was being presented as the dominant frame. By presenting the critique as the dominant frame, they could go off and do other things. And from that moment on, their essays were just incredibly critical, engaged, and exciting to read, which as a teacher, it's always great if you can get exciting essays to read. So I've taught varieties of that course ever since. You know, I've moved institutions, but I take that learning with me. The other thing that I did, and it's partly because I teach in the area of theory, and if any of you have done theory courses at school or at university, you know that it's often a particular demographic who gets to be understood as a theorist. And so talking to theory colleagues and saying, well, why not diversify the curriculum a bit? You know, there have been other people in the world across cultures, across genders, who've also thought and had particular ideas that we could engage with. But again, it's always that issue of time. Oh, I don't have time. I'd have to do too much reading. I don't know where to go to find these other authors. And so about 5 years ago, I set up a website called globalsocialtheory.org. And I crowdsourced short entries on thinkers that people thought it would be useful for people to know about. And so we have people like Frantz Fanon and Audre Lorde and Gayatri Spivak, people who are already recognized as theorists. But then we also have people like Cabral, Nkrumah, Morris Bishop, and people like Nina Simone. So you might know Nina Simone in terms of her songs. Her songs were often written by her, and they were reflections on the world within which she was living in. And there are insights that can be taken from her songs to understand both the time that she was a part of, as well as the time that we're currently in. So we were trying to expand the understanding of what theory is, who gets understood as producing theory, and what we could learn if we used other voices. So this is provided as a free resource. At the start of every term, I tweet it out, and people can either sort of just adopt entries from it, or at the very least put a link to that website on their module outlines so that students can click through it themselves if they're interested in it and find out about other people who have also thought and what they might have thought about and so on. And so I think that there are small things that we can do to address these sorts of issues. And we can work collaboratively and together, because no one of us is ever going to change the whole thing ourselves, but it's how we can do small things, work with each other to develop to provide resources for people who want to think differently about the world within which we live. So what I've tried to do in the brief comments that I've made here is just provide the broader context for the need to transform our everyday understandings. And hopefully I've also provided some evidence for why I think it's necessary for us to act and to set out an example of a couple of things that I've done in the university context to try and address these sorts of issues. Within the edited book, which was the title of this session, we've got chapters by colleagues in different contexts who've also done work within their own institutions to address the concerns that I'm raising here today. So there was colleagues in the Netherlands who organized a commission on decolonize, not diversify, because one of the ways in which people sometimes respond to the concerns that I've raised is, oh, well, we just need lots of different looking people in a room. Well, as we can see from the current cabinet, having different looking people doesn't necessarily make for transformative change. And so there's something more that's needed than simply diversity. We need to decolonize our understandings and think about how that would provide the possibility of doing things differently. So I'm really happy now to take comments, questions, and engage with you about the issues that I've raised, if you've got any questions. I think there's a mic.
Very much. It was at a talk yesterday by Joel Mokero, poet from Australia, who was talking about faith in terms of sculpted faith, unravelled faith, and woven faith, or thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And it sounds as though, very similarly in academia and the kinds of things you're talking about, maybe we're at a stage where we need a lot more vociferous unravelling before we can get to that sort of greater synthesis of the ideas.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true. And in part because of, I mean, the work that I do, the research that I do more generally is around thinking about the history that we acknowledge within our understandings of the present day as it's configured. And to think about what histories do we acknowledge and which histories do we not acknowledge and what difference does that make to the way in which we understand the world that we currently are part of. And my interest is thinking about the parochiality of the histories that we tell ourselves. So in the context of the current debates that have gone on around the vote to leave the European Union and so on, one of the key things that was presented within those debates was really about the need to reclaim our national sovereignty. And that rests on an understanding that we, Britain, were a nation state. But I would suggest to you that Britain has never been a nation state. Britain comes into being in 1707 through the union of the kingdoms of England and Scotland. Both England and Scotland already have colonies prior to union, including that of Ireland, including parts of the New World. When they enter into union, they go on to colonize over a quarter of the Earth's land territory and govern over one-fifth of its people. And the British Empire remains the political unit until 1948, when it gets transformed into the British Commonwealth. And then in 1973, when we join the European Economic Community, we join another transnational federation. So at no point in our history have we ever been a nation state. We've been an imperial state with a national project within it. Why is that important? Well, it's important because I grew up my whole life here with people, teachers, the media, and myself thinking that I was what we call a second-generation immigrant. And it wasn't until these debates were happening, I remember talking to my dad about these issues, and suddenly he brought out these passports. And, you know, I have a British passport, my parents have a British passport, my grandfather has a British passport. Every generation of my family that could have held a passport held a British passport, because we had been made British by empire. So I suddenly thought, well, actually, what would our current debates look like if we started from the fact that I'm British? Not a second generation migrant, not a whatever, but just that I'm British. If I was British, then how would we talk about the things that we're talking about? And that sort of shifted something for me in terms of these debates. And that's why I think acknowledging that history has an impact on how we understand the present. And that's why I'm committed to, I mean, I know it's become a bit of a buzzword, decolonizing the university, but I've been doing this work from long before it became that buzzword. And to me, that's what it means. It means reckoning with the actual histories that produced us and then having a conversation about what we go on to do.
Hi, thank you for your talk and your work. I'm a university lecturer and we use anonymous marking for everything we do. I wondered what your views were on that in terms of the attainment gap. Do you think it's do you think it's an effective tool, or do you have any thoughts about anonymous marking?
Yes, I mean, I do. I mean, so there hasn't been a huge amount of research on this, and hopefully now that it's become much more of a live political issue, there will be more research associated with it. But one of the reasons why the BAME attainment gap is seen to be less within the sciences rather than the social sciences and humanities is because there are more correct answers, or they do multiple choice stuff. So an answer is either right or wrong. Once you bring subjective sort of accounts into it, that provides the space for marking differently. And within universities, we very rarely now mark anonymously, except at first years, because if you've got a class of 30 students and the students come and talk to you about the essays that they're going to write, when you come to mark them, you basically know whose essay you're engaging with, because we mark our own students' work. So we don't really have true anonymous marking in the way that you might do at first year, when it's a class of 500 and you're just marking 100 of them and you've got no idea. So that's different. So it would be interesting to have a study done between whether there's a gap at first year when marking is really anonymous, and whether the gap increases or is produced at second and third year when marking becomes less anonymous. But I think anonymity would make a big difference, because this is about the subjective expectations that teachers bring with them, because we're not outside of society, we're formed by exactly the same processes that we might be criticising, and so how do we mitigate against the negative effects of those processes is an important thing.
Hello, I just wondered about post-anthropocentrism, and sort of, I studied in the Netherlands for a while, where there's a huge movement about sort of decolonising knowledge. And we learned about sort of the Zapatista movement, and in South America, Gloria Anzal Dua writing amazing work. So I wondered sort of how we sort of bring that into our understanding in modern day, especially with sort of climate crisis, about moving from that sort of Cartesian split of sort of focus on the individual and the human and the man and what that means, to all these knowledges that have existed forever in all of these different sort of knowledge production sites that we don't acknowledge, that have already gone beyond the human, and how we bring that into our understanding and our movements today.
So, I mean, that's a huge question, and in a way there is obviously knowledges produced out of other contexts which also need to be engaged with and thought through and so on. I think the work that I've set myself to do is to think about how, even within the dominant paradigms, one can hold the dominant paradigm to account in terms of its own standards and its own arguments, because it doesn't even meet those. And so what are the gaps and the knowledges that we need to address there? So you mentioned climate change. One of the things that I would want to say is that there's been a lot of stuff in the media and the newspapers recently, and rightly so, about how we are facing imminent climate catastrophe, that within a couple of years, this global warming is going to get so high, and you know, the climate is going to change so irrevocably that it's going to destroy our world. But what we haven't really taken on board is that our world is based on the destruction of the worlds of others. So the only way that we can live the way that we do is because we've destroyed the possibility of living for so many indigenous peoples around the world and native peoples in other parts of the world, that they're already facing 50 degrees and the complete sort of drying up of the water table in those areas. Climate change refugees are refugees that are produced as a consequence of our actions. So it's not what should we do about climate change when it affects us. The thing is, we're already doing things that's producing climate change for others. What are we going to do to change the way in which we choose to live our lives so that the planet can be inhabitable for all the people who live upon it? And that requires us both to unlearn and rethink what we understand as normal. And a lot of that will definitely be about engaging with the experiences of others and the knowledges produced by others about what it is possible to do and what it's not possible to do. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your work. I'm an academic at a UK institution as well, and I'm part of the Decolonizing the Curriculum movement. And we face a lot of resistance, as I'm sure you have as well. And I just wondered how to respond to some of that resistance, the comments from senior academics or even colleagues and peers of, we don't want to lose quality by diversifying the curriculum, and just constant resistance, basically.
Yep. So, for me, this is a question of standards. It is a question of quality and it's a question of rigor. And I don't think that it's possible to have standards or rigor without engaging with the resources that one uses within the teaching that we do. So in that sense, I would suggest that diversity isn't the enemy of excellence. And what does it mean to be excellent in a monochrome world? Is one way of sort of presenting it. The other thing I would say, and this is, you know, Toni Morrison, who died recently, said that the real effect of racism is to distract you, is to make you think, oh no, I've got to prove that the culture I came from did have great learning, and it did. I just take all of that as read. So I don't feel the need to prove anything about anything. All I want is for us to recognize the histories that have produced us. And the fact that we don't, and most of our curricula don't recognize the histories that we've produced us, I think that there's a deficiency within those curricula, and there's no way we can have excellent teaching if we don't address it. So I would just turn it back on them. Yep.
Thanks for a wonderful talk. I'm another academic at a UK university. I'm teaching in engineering. I wonder whether you could say something about stereotype bias, and also the way that we stereotype students. Mm-hmm. So. Many of my colleagues would say, oh, well, you know, the Chinese students, the East Asian students, they're really good at the maths, but, you know, they're not creative, whereas the other students are more creative, particularly when we see their marks in design, but when, you know, they're not so good at maths. And is that just... And I was curious about, you know, when you break down the BME and you see that Indian and Chinese students do better, Pakistani students do less well, and then... Blacks or Afro-Caribbean root students do bottom of the pile, and whether you could talk a little bit about that more, or that's too many questions.
Okay, no. So, again, I think it's that aspect that all of us are shaped by the world within which we live and the societal norms and expectations that produce that world. And so we can't imagine ourselves outside of it, but we can be reflexive about how we engage with others. And so if we find ourselves doing that, to have a conversation about it and have a conversation with others. And it might often be, and it usually is the case, that other people will tell us when we're making those sorts of assumptions. And so to listen. And I think that's one thing, instead of getting reactive and defensive about stuff, why not listen when somebody says, oh, actually, I think you're making a generalization here. Could we think about this a different sort of way? So I think that that sort of work really needs to be done, and it often needs to be done not just by those colleagues who are most affected by particular sorts of processes, but for all of us, because I don't think we can have an excellent university system without all of us being committed to producing an excellent university system. And then what was the second? The differentiation. I mean, the differentiation is partly, you know, I mean, there's an aspect. A lot of that, I think, would link into socioeconomic backgrounds and engagement through, and again, linked to stereotypes. So as I was saying, you know, the one thing that the Race Equality Chartermark, which produces the Equality Challenge Unit, which has set up the Race Equality Chartermark, is very stringent on, is that you cannot start from an idea of a deficit in the student. If there are these disparities, then the reason for those disparities has got nothing to do with the demographic characteristics of the student, but they've got something to do with the institution and how it treats students of that demographic. So how do universities begin to tackle this? I mean, one issue is the fact that we have employed so few Black and Afro-Caribbean academics, and the number of female Black Afro-Caribbean academics is abysmally small. So there are ways in which we need to address that, and also think about how we address it without simply internationalizing. So at Warwick, where I was, I became a professor, I was the only Black, and I'm using that in the broad term, Black British academic professor within the social sciences. There were other Black professors, but they were all from Kenya, or they were African American, or they were Nigerian, or from India, and so on. So we can't address the issues of racial inequality by also looking just simply bringing in talent from outside. Why are we not producing talent inside? What are those sorts of issues?
I'm a PhD student. I'm doing biomedical engineering, and I want to. A lot of the kind of examples that you've given are about kind of like sociology and kind of the humanities. And I guess where do you see this movement affecting physical sciences and health sciences and kind of that end of the spectrum as well?
Yeah. So I think there it becomes partly in the issues around marking, but as I said, that's sort of less as well in these areas because there are more right answers or there are sorts of different sorts of issues in relation to that. And again, there just hasn't been the funding to address these, to research these issues. So there is very little systematic research on the production of racial inequalities within higher education, either as a whole or then differentiated by subject and so on. So I think that's something that we do need to do. And at the same time, we need to recognise that there are some things that we've already learnt about what happens and how do we address those things. I think thinking about the biases that are there, thinking about what our expectations are and how we might mitigate against the problematic aspects of what our expectations are, and having those sorts of conversations, so simply talking about these issues amongst the groups that can make a difference, will already begin to make a difference, hopefully, because people will then start reflecting upon those sorts of issues. So it's about collegiality. It's about, do you just say sometimes just, you know, oh, okay, we finished this, should we go to the pub? And not think whether the pub is perhaps the ideal venue for everybody to go to. Or you could go to a cafe instead, or you know, just sort of these sorts of things. How do we have those conversations? And how do we think about who makes us up?
Thank you very much for making us think. And I come from the conservatoire sector, music performance, mm-hmm. which I think has a particularly strong cultural history based in Western classical music, which there is a beginning of a movement to change that. But I wonder, could you give any advice on what decolonising the conservatoire might look like?
I honestly don't believe in roadmaps or toolkits, or I think there is stuff that we can learn and there is work that people have done, and some people have produced excellent toolkits and roadmaps, so we can go and look at those. So SOAS has produced an excellent toolkit around decolonising the curriculum. Other colleagues in other places have produced work. So I think for each of us, if we think that change is needed, what is it that provoked us to think that change was needed? And where could we go to find the resources to help us enact that change? Some of it might be to talk to colleagues in cognate areas who are already doing the work. And some of it might be to do the reading and then apply the reading to the problem you've identified to try and figure out a solution amongst yourself and your colleagues in relation to this sort of stuff. I think that when I produced this book with my colleagues, and it was called Decolonizing the University, and I'd actually wanted to call it How to Make the University a Bit Better, because in a way, but my publisher didn't think that that would sell or be sexy enough and so on. But I do think that it's about making our institution a bit better. It's about identifying what's problematic, and in the process of trying to make it a bit better, we might actually make it a lot better, and we might do more. But if we set ourselves an unattainable goal, then we just sort of say, oh, well, you know, nothing can be done, it's just too big, and so on. Let's do what can be done. And in terms of everything that I've said today, the one thing, if any of you are involved in higher education and so on, for me, the key thing is to eliminate the BAME attainment gap, because that's the thing that has lifelong consequences for young BAME students. It follows them through, because if you don't get a 2-1 at university, through no fault of your own, you don't get access to good quality jobs, you don't get access to further funding to do further education and all those sorts of things. It has an impact across the life course.
Thanks again. I'm also a lecturer. Just returning to that model, continuing with the marking gap question, has any research been done looking at the ethnicity of the marker and whether the gap persists or does not? Because I know some research has been done in relation to gender on that issue.
Yeah.
And some studies have shown a gap persists mm-hmm. irrespective of the gender in the market, but nothing on ethnicity.
Nothing that I know of, and it wouldn't surprise me if the gap continued to persist, because as I said, we're all formed by the same social system. It's not as if we're, you know, but what one of the things that I think does make a difference is I saw slides from a talk that Faiza Shaheen did at the LSE a little while ago, and she had a slide up in which there were two lines which then crossed. So you had two lines which then crossed at one point. And these two lines were the marks of white students at the top and BMA students below it. And this was at school. And then suddenly the lines moved in the opposite direction at, I think it was at age 16. And it's like, well, what happens at age 16? Oh, that's the point at which the marks associated with the student are delivered anonymously through anonymous marking, whereas before it was based on teacher expectations. So it was really quite extraordinary how that flip occurs. And so it is about the expectations that we have of the pupils that are in front of us. And it's also about how, as soon as we anonymize it, it equalizes and it changes. But I don't know of any specific research that identifies the ethnicity of the marker with that of the student.
If I can just ask a follow-up then. I guess one of the thoughts going through my head is whether pedagogy makes any difference in terms of whether that could be a factor in any way. Mm-hmm. Particularly, I'm thinking here of students maybe whose primary and secondary education wasn't in the UK or used to a different style of pedagogy. So, any reflections?
But I'm concerned with students whose primary and secondary education was in the UK and these consequences still pertain to them. And I'm, you know, so I think I'm not a fan of the flipped classroom if partly that was where you were going to. I think lectures, seminars and reading are a perfect triumvirate of how to get knowledge across and engaged with in particular sorts of ways.
Thanks. I wonder if you could comment on how Western missionary activities is currently discussed within post-colonialism discussion in the West. And I asked for a specific reason, because I was involved in a conversation with Zimbabwean theological educators recently, and I wanted to know what advice they would give me as a person working in the West in theological education, you know, handling my own white privilege and all those kind of issues. And their response was took me by surprise. They said, we can't speak really very easily about post-colonialism in Zimbabwe, and the discussions you have in the West are in a context which is so secular that the people who are discussing post-colonialism simply don't understand the ambiguity of the Western missionary movement. Mm-hmm. So I was really taken aback by that. I wonder whether you'd comment.
I mean, that may well be true. I'm afraid I don't know enough to be able to respond to that question. I think, for me, in terms of doing this sort of work, it's really about thinking about how the structures of inequality that currently exist have been shaped by particular histories. And so even the language of white privilege that almost individualizes the process, I don't find particularly helpful, because on one level, for me, it's not about the individuals, it's about the structures. The structures that have been established on the basis effectively of 500 years of colonization that have instantiated a particular type of racialized hierarchy into our world, such that we don't even often recognize that it exists, because it's just the normal everyday of our existence. And so how, if we were to uncover the histories that actually produced us, would we also be able to undo the racialized inequalities that structure our world? And so in that context, for me, the work is around structures, not issues of privilege and individual. And this is also why I think the stuff around unconscious bias is truly problematic, because none of this is unconscious. We reproduce these structures in a particular way because they benefit us. And that has to be addressed, yep.
So I absolutely hate asking questions, so I'm working out, trying to work out the energy to form this. I work for an NGO that is concerned with tackling inequality in the global research and knowledge system. And so I wanted to know, in terms of your efforts to decolonize education and research, how do you deal with the inherent biases in the sources of information globally?
Well, in part by looking for other sources of information as well with which we can engage with this. So I'll give you one example. I've just been doing some research and looking at capitalism. It's a very broad sort of thing. And most theories about capitalism talk about capitalism emerging as a consequence of changes in the natures of the social relations of production within England, or as a consequence of the expansion of markets. So you have markets that then eventually expand, and the changing dynamic produces capitalism. But within all the theories of capitalism that exist within, that emerge out of our university systems and so on, none of them make colonialism or slavery central to their understandings of what capitalism is. And in the course of doing research, I came across some work that had been done by Indian scholars in the 1800s and so on, who were detailing the amount of money that British traders in India were extracting from India. And as I was saying before, you know, over 200 years, this became the equivalent of $45 trillion worth of wealth that was extracted from India. The idea that this wealth had nothing to do with the possibility of establishing the Industrial Revolution or the wealth of Britain in any particular way is just remarkable. But you won't necessarily find that within British accounts of this. So we have to read more broadly. We have to engage with research being done by colleagues and people in other parts of the world, bring it together and see if it matches. And if it doesn't, well, how do we assess which one is more rigorous? What are the standards by which we assess the legitimacy of the knowledge that's being produced? Do we think that us saying we abolish slavery is just fine as a statement? Or do we have to contextualize that in the context of, well, we profited from it for 200 years. We then compensated those people who had owned other people. We then didn't let the people who had been enslaved to actually be free for another 6 years because they had to work to buy their freedom further. And all these other, how do we contextualize it? Who do we listen to? So bringing the different sources together and judging between them, I think, is necessary.
Can I add another thing? Yep. Just because I'm, you know, I know there's lots of academics in the audience, and just to urge, well, I guess to recognise the biases in the evaluation of research, particularly the evaluations of journals, and huge biases. So I, that's not really a question. That's just like adding extra bit.
Thank you. Any last questions? Yeah.
I do a little bit of work in secondary schools, uh-huh. And Bell Hooks has really, really helped me with thinking about pedagogy. She talks about radical openness, mm-hmm. like kind of inhabiting, like educators and students inhabiting those marginal, uncertain places. And I just wondered, I'm trying to explore what does that mean, but I'd love to know anything that you have to say about that.
What does that, well, I guess, you know, partly the sort of small anecdote I shared earlier about going home and saying to my dad, oh, isn't it great, the British built railways in India, and him sort of saying, you know, what? And then going to school and just, and actually, you know, it's that aspect that what the teachers told me wasn't necessarily the end of the story. So how else could I question, where else could I find the sources that told me this? Because there isn't necessarily access to other sorts of information at that time. But when students today ask me, you know, how do you know what you know about this stuff? And it's like, well, I read books, I read newspapers, I try, and it's not necessarily reading books in other languages, although if you have other languages, that's great as well. But so much stuff is already written in English that we still don't read and take account of. You know, we could read, if we're interested in capitalism, we could read Eric Williams. We could read these other scholars who've sort of addressed these issues differently. So I think that aspect of openness, it's a obviously a great perspective from which to think about teaching and to think about how one engages with students and so on as well. And one of the things that I would be clear on is that teaching and learning for me is not just that everybody has their own perspective, and that's great because everybody's, you know, got their opinion. I tell my students, and it sometimes slightly shocks them, that I'm really not interested in their opinions. They can have whatever opinions they want. What I'm interested in is their analysis, is the way in which they find data, they read stuff, they engage with it, and they come to a considered, they have considered thoughts about it. That's what I want to know from them. So that's slightly different from just openness. It's a guided process of getting students to reflect on what it is that we give them and ask them to think about it and then speak in relation to that.
Right, oh well, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Great Thinking, Ideas and Conversations from Greenbelt. At Greenbelt, we make a space where artistry meets activism, where the political meets the practical, where the sacred meets the secular. We think we're somewhere to dream up a better world, to dance and debate, to pray and to party. Visit greenbelt.org.uk to browse and download other great thinking from our recorded catalogue. We're Greenbelt. We're somewhere to believe in.